Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Want to give a shout-out to all of our sponsors as former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller joins us, and he has been joining our friends at the Harker for a little wake and bake coffee ice cream with the fudge swirl made in Baltimore. And, of course, our friends also made here in Baltimore, Fadley's, making those delicious crab cakes and shipping them all over the world. We did a great segment last week at Baltimore Positive about where those crabs come from out of Chesapeake Bay and how they wind up becoming crab cakes on your plate when you order them. You check that out at Baltimore Positive. Don, I want you to say a few words about State Fair, because I got over there for the poutine the other night, but I know there's big doings over in the 21228.
Big doings at State Fair. They're knocking it out of the park with you can dine under the tent there. Great social distancing. No reason to fear anything. They're getting high marks, actually, from all the governmental officials I spoke to, said the State Fair is really doing it the right way. Getting ready to open up a brand new Mexican restaurant across the street, El Guapo. That should open up in a couple of weeks. And, of course, we're sponsored by our friends at Moeller and Gary Realtors. Jeff Moeller, selling, buying, listing, you name it. There's a lot going on in that real estate market. Just actually ran into Jeff earlier today. He said it's the hottest market he's seen in 10 years. So now's the time to buy or sell. Get back out there. Give Jeff a call, 410-746-1547. Well, Nestor, you've been bugging me to get our next guest on, and I know you're excited because you've been looking forward to this segment.
Michael Steele, I wanted you to be one of our top five because, you know, I have your MFR, my favorite Republican, is what you've become. So, I know you're from back in the Ehrlich days, and former RNC, and you pop up on a Bill Maher, you pop up on a CNN or an MSNBC. I see you all over the place. And I said, man, we really need to sit down and talk. And as it turns out, waiting a year and a half, it's perfect, because the country's right where we need it right now to have you on.
We welcome former Lieutenant Governor of the state of Maryland and former chair of the RNC, Michael Steele, to Baltimore Positive. And Michael, let's just jump in and say, this ain't your Republican Party, is it?
It's a little different. It's a little different. That's for sure. Well, first off, let me just give a shout out to the two of you. It was love. I just love listening to what I described as the State Fair and just the hometown feel of Baltimore. It's really good to hear that and to feel that. And Don, thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
Certainly to the county and to the state. And Esther, God bless you, baby. I don't know where you get the energy, man. You're just a firecracker.
I get younger.
He's the Energizer Bunny, isn't he, Governor? He's the Energizer Governor.
Holy, just amazing. But yeah, it's a different. We're in a different space now, for sure. A lot of change from heck, time I was a county chairman in Prince George's County back in the 1990s, and certainly from days as national chairman in 2010. In 9 to 11. But I kind of take it all in, and people ask me all the time, oh, how can you be a Republican? Why are you still a Republican? I say, look, I'm like a Motel 6. Someone's got to keep the lights on, right? You got to stay with the ideas and the values and the principles that brought you to the party in the first place.
Well, boy, that's shifted, hasn't it? I mean, like, you literally, a lot of the people who consider themselves the Republicans and the QAnons, that they wouldn't call you a real Republican, even though you haven't moved. It sort of has moved from my eyes.
Yeah, they have moved. And, you know, and I'm sorry, you don't get to judge what kind of Republican I am. I never judged you when you were out there making your noise. This is what I say to them. I said, So what gives you the right to judge my 40-plus years as a Republican? You didn't walk in my shoes. You didn't fight the battles I fought. In fact, I don't even remember seeing you on the battlefield at the time that I was having those fights as a Republican growing up in Washington, D.C., as a Republican who moved into Maryland in 1986. So don't sit there and think that somehow you got the dibs on me. You need to account to those of us who have been in the fight, who stood in the trench, who held up the flag and the banner, who said that we value liberty and freedom and opportunity. And I didn't do that by judging others. I didn't do that by calling out Republicans who I may have disagreed with. And that has always been the strength of the party. And to now watch some of these idiots, because that's what they are, in my view, who think that they have the brand right and they understand. And, you know, tell me what you're winning. Tell me who you're influencing. How many votes are you going to collect? You know, how many seats have you lost since you opened your mouth? So this is the internal fight that the party is going to have to go through. It has been going in and out of that fight, gentlemen, since Reagan left the office in 1989. This sort of, you know, what is Republicanism? What is conservatism? And people need to understand they're two very distinct things. You can be a Republican and not a conservative, and you can be a conservative and not a Republican. And what has happened is this has all been mashed up in some way that you can't be one without being the other, which I completely renounce, because that's not been my lived experience working with, you know, an array of people from Reagan to Jack Kemp to, you know, everyone in between. So I just think that this struggle is something that we need to gird ourselves for as, you know, we get through this election cycle and certainly what comes afterwards.
Well, I think that summer of 16, that, you know, beginning in the winter when Trump started to get up and demean women, you know, from 5 feet away on a wide stage, that was the 6 month period. And I'm not sure who your candidate was. I'm not a Republican, but I mean, I would have certainly considered voting for John Kasich. You know what I mean? And Marco Rubio seemed to have had even some shine at that point and has showed himself over the last 4 years to be pretty cowardly, quite frankly, in addition to Ted Cruz and some of these other people. But that 6 month period, when you think about what that represented for what was to come in this victory aided by Russia, all of that, 4 years later, where our country is, that if somehow one of those other candidates, Carly Fiorina, any of those candidates would have been there, that's the part of it that if I'm doing revisionist history, I go back to there and say, what happened to these 63 million people?
Yeah, and that's a good point, and you're right. It is a critical moment. Because it really, we were on that precipice of throwing away the things that we claim that we value and have fought for and took stock in for almost two generations, and stepping off that cliff with someone who was quite honestly a foreigner to those values. I mean, people forget the president switched to the Republican Party 15, 16 months before he ran for office. So don't sit there, all you QAnon and all these other folks out here who claim, you know, Trumpism. Your birthright is very, very short. It's not, you don't have lineage here. You don't have stock here. And so I think we need to be mindful of that. And you don't get to rewrite the history of the party. And you don't get to rewrite its value system and its principles to fit the idea or ideals of one individual. We didn't do it with Reagan, who was arguably the most popular president outside of FDR in the 20th century. So, you know, why do we seem to want to do that now is beyond me and a lot of folks as we look at where the party has come from that moment that you describe in 2016, where some very clear choices could have been made. A lot of us look to the Kasichs and the Rubios, the Chris Christies and others to emerge, to sort of pick up that mantle of Reagan, Bush, Eisenhower, et cetera, you know, the William F. Buckley, style of philosophical conservatism. And we essentially walked away from that because we were so angry about stuff, and we internalized that anger and turned it in on ourselves and went after the very institutions and individuals that literally four years before, we were not even 4 years before, we were applauding and supporting, and we saw as advocates for what we believed in.
Well, Michael, I want to continue to build on these themes, because I want to go back to 2009 when you're elected chair of the mm-hmm. RNC. And correct, I'm going to give you a premise, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. But I okay. remember you, and even at Karl Rove. Now, I realize Karl Rove is like the devil incarnate to many Democrats. Right. But even Karl Rove at that time wrote a paper talking about expanding the base of the Republican Party from traditional older white men to really becoming dominant among Hispanics, more popular in the suburbs. And I remember you, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but going on a lot of shows and making the circuit saying, look, if we're going to be a Republican Party that really thrives in the next few decades, we've got to broaden this tent. Now, is my history correct?
Your history is correct. And in fact, to nail that point, I gave a speech in 2009, probably within the first 6 weeks of my chairmanship, in which I declared emphatically that the Southern strategy was dead. And just to refamiliarize your audience with that, that was the strategy chosen by Nixon in 1968 to peel off disaffected white Southern men who were pissed off, quite honestly, that Johnson started to embrace the civil rights movement. It was in that decision by Nixon to move away from civil rights. And ironically, the Nixon administration is noted for promoting a number of policies that were beneficial to African Americans at the time. But his move away from civil rights began to break what a lot of us thought was an inextricable link between African Americans, Republicans, and Republicans, who African Americans had been members of the Republican Party since emancipation. So you're looking at 100 years of history that in literally the blink of an eye or the moment of a decision, it started to erase that legacy. And so I wanted to make it very clear as national chairman that we were no longer supporting that view of politics. We were no longer engaging in that view and set about to prove it. And ran into a lot of resistance.
Imagine that.
Probably from some of the same numbnuts who are running their mouths today. But
right.
the reality of it is, there was a real effort to do that, because we recognized, as which I began to recognize back in 2000 when I was Maryland State Party chairman, that demographically the party was falling behind. And I just looked at my own state of Maryland and then looked at other states like Texas. I said back in 2002 that Texas would be a blue state within 20 years. And here we are. And why?
And they may beat your record. Right.
Right. So we have to be mindful of what the country's telling us. And politics at its core is about that very thing. It used to be about listening and then responding to the currents and the movements. Today, what politics tries to do is to dictate those currents and those movements. And the way they do it is by preying on the fears and the angers and the anxieties of the populace, which is why there's such distrust of our political system, unlike we've ever seen before.
On a personal level, what do you feel like you still have in common with the Republican Party on a daily basis, from let's not wear masks and open the country, all of this rhetoric that I, quite frankly, every time you talk, you sound more like a Democrat than a Republican, and because of your background. But, I mean, I'm trying to figure out in your mind what keeps you aligned with the Republican Party.
Well, like I said, I got to keep the lights on. But how is saying, wear a mask sound like a Democrat? It speaks right. to the how crazy it is. I mean, this idea that we've allowed ourselves to get duped into a political farce of thinking that wearing a mask is a political statement. It's your friggin' health, dummy. This isn't about politics. This is about keeping your dumb behind alive.
This is an IQ test, right?
It's more important than keeping your family members and people you come into contact with from getting affected from your stupidness. That's about. So this idea that if I wear a mask, I'm not supporting the president. That is so, so unintelligent. I mean, it is just think about the sentence I just stated, that if I wear a mask, that means I don't support the president. Or if I wear a mask, if I don't wear a mask, that means I do support the president. I mean, you cannot make it more dumb than that. Come on.
No, Michael, you cannot make this stuff up. And I want to go back, because I think it all ties together, to the point you just made moments ago as well, which was you're looking at Texas. Now, you and I are recovering politicians. We've looked at numbers all our lives. As RNC chair, you work numbers over and over and over. You look at spreadsheets every which way, cross tabs from this poll and that poll. You know how to analyze that stuff. And what I keep saying to folks is, what people like you and Rove and others understood was that to become truly dominant in elective politics in the United States of America, the Republicans didn't need to peel off 30, 40, and 50% of the African-American vote and the Hispanic vote and the suburban white woman vote. They needed to peel off 8 to 10 to 12%, and they'd be unbeatable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because you know, you're absolutely right. Your analysis is spot on and is one of the things that was really the cornerstone of the success that we built in 2010. You know, people always marvel, oh, well, how did you win all the? I mean, it's funny because, you know, Rove and I had a disagreement. And he wrote in the op-ed, you know, in the Wall Street Journal at the time that I didn't know what I was talking about when I was, you know, talking about what the election outcome could possibly be in November. And, of course, in January, it was very hard to predict whether or not Republicans would win in that November. I refused to do that. Got into trouble on Sean Hannity's show for not doing that because it'd be irresponsible. But at the same time, recognizing what the trend lines were saying and what the strategies that would be required to meet those trend lines would have to look like. And you're absolutely right that it doesn't require a heavy lift.
No.
It requires something so simple, so straightforward, and they're encapsulated in the words my mother uttered to me when I was a young boy. And I think I've applied it to virtually everything I've done in my public life. And those words are, shut up and listen. Because the voters will tell you how connected you are or aren't to them. And if you understand and appreciate that, then you will know that it won't take a whole lot to convince them that what you're offering is worth the risk, that what you're proposing is worth their investigation, and what you want to do is worth their vote. And so it's just a matter of understanding and appreciating exactly what voters have been saying all along. And at the end of the day, I still believe America is a center-right nation. I really believe that. And my friends on the left will argue it's a center-left nation. That's fine. That's where the sweet spot of policy is formed. That's where the sweet spot of consensus is built. I get that. But we have moved off of that now to the point where we can't even have that kind of acknowledgement of where the country is and what it is, because everybody's trying to shape it into its own image. And that is the unfortunate part of all of this. So you don't need to get 30% of the black vote to win an election. You just need to get one more percent than you got the last time. And that's all it takes. It's a building process that for the Republicans is rooted in a very rich history. One that we should be proud of, one that we should be talking about, and it doesn't boil down to this idea as, well, you know, at least black unemployment is the lowest it's ever been, or we gave you opportunity zone. Yes, but if you're tone deaf on my civil rights struggle, if you're tone deaf on my voting rights struggle, it doesn't matter that black unemployment is the lowest it's ever been. They're not going to vote for you. As simple
and
as
the
that.
The support now is lower than it's ever been. And as you point out, it doesn't have to be that way. So now I want you to put your professorial hat on. I want you to become Professor Steele. And for those listening, we're with former Lieutenant Governor of the State of Maryland, Michael Steele, MSNBC contributor and host of the Michael Steele podcast. Go out there and get it wherever you get your podcast. Just type in the Michael Steele podcast. So
there you go.
Let's put your Michael Steele podcast hat on. And here you are trying to expand the Republican Party in 2009. We're about 1 year into the Obama administration. And this orange man developer from New York begins to play with fire that became known as birtherism.
Mm-hmm.
The same guy who still believes the Central Park Five is guilty, despite all the DNA evidence to the contrary. The same man today who is president, in a recent meeting with staffers, says the problem was that he hasn't been racist enough recently. And we see that, I think, reflected in his recent tweets. He said, I obviously wasn't racist enough, so I'll go out and attack Bubba Wallace, and I'll stand up for the Confederate flag. So, Professor, how do we get a Donald Trump? How do we get the 45th president of the United States? Give me that roadmap.
It's a roadmap that was laid long before Donald Trump even showed up. Remember, this was what, Donald's third or fourth time either thinking about or actually trying to attempt to run for the presidency. So that space wasn't foreign to him. You're going back to the late 1980s, Donald Trump was toying around with the idea of running for president then as a Democrat or as a member of some party that was made up.
The Opportunist Party, yes.
Right, whatever it was. So that part of it is not that surprising. But the roadmap itself was laid long before he showed up, and it began going back really to about the 2000 election. That's when the nature of our politics changed. And it does go a little bit to what Karl Rove did in that election, where he changed the paradigm. Remember, back in the day, red states were Democrats, blue states were Republicans. When you go back and you look at the national maps and how they were colorized, if you will, on election night, it's the opposite of what they were. Rove changed that, and he embraced the red state strategy in the 2000 campaign, and that's when that changed. What changed was the dynamic, the interpersonal relationship between the parties as well as the voters. And it became more of a us versus them. And when the whole thing ended up in a tie, that's what set in motion a lot of the anxiety and the angst and the frustration coming off of, you know, a Bill Clinton presidency where we saw social mores and, quote, family values degenerate. Coming off of, you know, the Reagan presidency where we saw, you know, the sort of secretive side of, you know, government misbehavior in Iran-Contra. You know, so you had all these little elements that began to germinate and form up in a way that really ate at the voters. And what I heard, certainly along that timeline, particularly in the 2006 election when I ran for the U.S. Senate for the state of Maryland, well, a lot of these voters had enough, and they were sick and tired, and they were tired of political leaders not listening to them. They were tired of being used, and certainly on the conservative side, they were tired of being promised something that was never going to materialize, repealing Roe versus Wade, fighting for family values, pushing economic reforms, because remember, the Bush administration was big government Republicanism, where the size of federal government expanded, the national debt expanded, deficits were created. And so that ate at a lot of people, center-right people, independent, conservative, Republican, and it manifests itself and germinated to the point you had someone come along like Trump, who knew how to take advantage of it, who knew how to brand it, who knew how to talk about it, who knew how to pick at those old scabs and wounds, and he did so very successfully. And what was stunning about 16 was to watch the political, I guess the political glitterati, the elite of the party, from governors to senators to businessmen and women, fall at his feet, get abused by him. And so Trump became the avatar for a lot of very angry voters out there. And they didn't like Hillary, and that was it. That was just starting with the Democrats. You had to get to Republicans. And so it was a non-starter on the Republican side when the choice was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So you see this sort of ability to speak to, become an avatar for a lot of anger and frustration. So he's not the problem. He really kind of demonstrated the symptoms and became the space where people rested. And when he stood up there and put up a piece of paper with a bunch of names saying, these are the men and women I will put on the Supreme Court, right? Voters are like, you're the first guy to actually, okay, so now accountability. You're holding yourself accountable. And they like that. They gravitated to that.
Well, Michael, looking back at 16, because I think you've just given a great history lesson on it. Again, you were in these rooms in the past as chair of the party. I think people forget, and Nestor, you alluded to that spring and summer of 16, forget that in the very first few primaries, it went on for, you know, the first 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks, Trump was winning, but he was winning with 25% of the vote, 28% of the vote, because the other 15 candidates were dividing up the other 70%. But talk to us and our listeners about what prevented, at that point, what prevented those 15 guys from making phone calls and saying, all right, fellas, we're going to meet at the pub tonight. It's going to be a closed-door meeting. We're not leaving until we pick one of us. Everybody else is going to try. What prevented them from coalescing around another candidate? Was it the belief, the fact that they couldn't bring themselves to believe that this guy was for real?
It was that. They didn't think it was real. They didn't think he would catch on. But the obviously the polling was belying that. But the one thing that kept them from doing what you just described, ego, because they all thought they could be president. They all thought that, you know, I'm going to give you a visual moment, and you're probably going to go, damn, you're right. Remember in the debate where Trump went after Jeb Bush, and he went after Jeb Bush, went after his wife, and Jeb Bush turned the tables and pushed back on Trump and basically called him out. In that moment, what happened? Jeb Bush stood alone. Not one person on that stage came to his defense. Not one person on that stage spoke up and took down what Trump said. And that for me was a very critical moment, because it said to me that these guys don't get what just happened and don't understand the opportunity they just missed to stop Trump. Because if they had, as we've seen in subsequent debates on the Democratic side, when Kamala Harris went after Joe Biden, there were one or two people on that stage who came to Joe's rescue and basically, you know, said, you know, I may not have liked where he stood on the crime bill, but, you know, boom, 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 he did this, he did that. So there was sort of a support there. Absent that support, Trump just basically realized one very, very basic rule on the playground. If I get to punk you and the schoolyard doesn't push back, I will punk you all day long. And that's what he did. And he went on and he systematically took everyone down, because he knew no one would come to the defense of the other, because they were too concerned about, well, if I support Jeb Bush in this moment, that will elevate his vote and his totals and his support and make him the nominee.
Well, the schoolyard example, Michael, is terrific, because he came up with schoolyard nicknames for each and every one of them. Right?
Yep.
I mean, well, but that speaks to the base. The base wanted a bully. The base, and
right.
He literally was the only bully on the stage, other than maybe Huckabee. You could say Rand Paul to some degree, but
Chris Christie to some degree. Chris Christie was the original bad boy, but he got outflanked by Trump.
Right.
Well, he didn't have an answer for that.
There's a part of this that we haven't even discussed, and you brought it up very, very briefly in talking about Sean Hannity, which we try not to bring his name up too much around here. But Fox News' role in this over the last 20 years since back when you and Bob Ehrlich were in Annapolis, and what that's become and the outlie of Rush Limbaugh and what is a fact and what is news and what is fiction and what is, quite frankly, party rhetoric throughout all of this. And Fox News has really been the conduit for all of this to happen. If there's no Fox News, none of this happens, in my belief.
Well, so the interesting thing about a Fox News and now the subsequent birth of other conservative news outlets from OWN to others is keep in mind that for, oh my gosh, 30 years or more, Republicans didn't have a media outlet. They didn't have a voice. Well, let's put it this way, conservatives specifically, but Republicans generally didn't have a media outlet. So when they looked at the national networks at the time, CBS, NBC, ABC, they didn't see themselves represented. They didn't hear their voice, their opinions on policy, their views on strategy, their outlook on the world reflected in any of those news stories. And to the extent that they were typically played down or put down or ignored or dismissed. So when Fox comes along, Fox creates this energy. But remember what happened even before Fox? Radio, AM radio. Talk radio.
I'm familiar with this.
You're very familiar with it, gentlemen. And it created a niche. It created a space for us to have the conversation that no one wanted us to have or certainly didn't want to hear on a national
level.
But
the only problem is so much of that conversation presented fiction as fact, Michael. I mean,
it's
so twisted that most of us can't have a conversation with most of you.
A minute. That's a recent iteration. And so that's very different from what I'm talking about, how this began. I worked at Fox for 2 years. So I know firsthand from the inside what it was like in 2007. After I left the lieutenant governor's office, I became a Fox analyst. I worked with Sean. I worked with a lot of those guys over there until I became national chairman in 2009.
Well, that's right around the time Obama was born in Kenya, right? Like right around then.
I want you to continue that thought, Michael. Continue that thought of working at Fox and what you saw.
Right, because that was not part of the narrative that I was aware of or familiar with at that time. And keep in mind that that storyline took hold, which was an abomination, which was dumb, and I never understood how any of us allowed that to go on for as long as it did, let alone to have Obama actually respond to it by producing his birth certificate, which my advice at the time was you'd be crazy to do. I would never do that. So why would you do that? You're friggin' president of the United States already. Get over it. But the fact of the matter is there was a calculation made very much on the media side that we saw on the political side, and that was audience, revenue. And what I witnessed when I went into the RNC was how money had become much more of a stranglehold and an outcome determinator of what you would do next, how you tell the story. And you realize that there are these shifts, these pressures that begin to build up. And if you don't have significant will inside to resist that, guess what? It becomes the new norm. It becomes the way things are done. But there's a price to be paid for that. And I think Fox now realizes that. I mean, look at the talent that they've lost, that have moved off. Look at what the price that they've paid for the misogyny and the internal, bad form and behavior, that they allowed to grow to sort of take down what started out as, legitimate, voice for conservatives. People forget Roger Ailes started where? In MSNBC. He worked over there. All right. So, and look how that network has changed in that time. MSNBC was very much a centrist. Tucker Carlson worked at MSNBC. Pat Buchanan. In fact, I replaced Pat Buchanan. I was there. We were there together for a while, and then he left. So this speaks to something else that's even more pervasive that we see coursing through the veins of not just our politics, but our media and our culture as a whole. And that's what we need to come to grips with, I think.
Well, Michael, looking at the whole, and you've been very generous with your time, looking at the whole landscape of what's happening nationally, go to 10,000 feet for us and describe what is happening in the nation post Aubrey Ahmad, post George Floyd. Give us sort of a sociological view in your sense of what is really transpiring in the nation at this point in our history.
I'd be happy to. So brace yourself, because I'm not going to be sparing in what I'm about to say. So I'm just giving you know me. You guys know me.
That's why I wanted you on last year, Michael, right?
What was that?
That's why I wanted you on last year.
Go ahead, Nestor. Rub it in. So what's happening now is something that took 401 years to happen, and that is a recognition that the great sin of this country, as some would put it, the great stain, as others would put it, of the United States has been not just slavery, but race, and how, as a country, we have dealt with or not dealt with that particular issue. And I think it's interesting that given all the other instances that have occurred in the last 6 years, for example, from Trayvon Martin right through to before the killing of George Floyd, the response was, oh my God, that's awful. Oh my God, yeah, we got to do something about that. But then nothing would move. Nothing would happen. There would be vigils. There would be, some protests. This movement called Black Lives Matter would form, and it would be summarily dismissed and treated as a pejorative or just outright ignored. And the response to this cry of Black Lives Matter by white folks was, well, all lives matter. Well, okay, I didn't say all lives didn't matter. I said Black Lives Matter. What we're trying to get you to understand is Black Lives Matter too. We matter as much as everyone else. Can you not at least acknowledge that? And everyone sort of said basically no and moved on. Something happened in 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And it was the combination of that event plus COVID-19. What else were you going to do? You were captive. You were a captured audience. You were there. You were stuck in your homes watching TV, and you got that image replayed over and over and over. And for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, watched man die. And that struck a nerve for a lot of white folks. And the recognition that what we have been saying in the black community for 400 years was not about reparations, was not about revenge, was not about anything other than what you yourselves have always preached and talked about, equality. And so now we're seeing this moment where white America is confronting its own internal assessment and approach to its own behavior. A friend of mine said to me, we were talking about this yesterday, and he said a white friend of his, called him up after watching the murder of George Floyd, and said, "Hey man, I just wanted to check in. How are you doing? How do you feel?" And he said, "That's not the question. The question isn't how do I feel. The question is how do you feel?"
Yeah.
And that's the important difference this time, because for the first time in a long time, I have to answer that question: how do I feel about what I just saw for 8 minutes and 46 seconds? And we'll see how that It's answered. I had a buddy laughing. You guys appreciate this. So Juneteenth, June 19th occurred, right? And you had all these marches and celebrations. And I turned to a friend of mine, and we were Zooming. I turned to him, I said, damn, white folks are more black than black folks on Juneteenth. I mean, you guys out here preaching and stomping, and a white buddy of mine goes, yes, this is important. I said, dude, we're over here at the barbecue. I don't know what you guys are marching about, but that's okay. We appreciate it. You know, but what's appreciated is finally you're kind of beginning to understand why we have to give the talk to our sons, that when they go out of their home to school, to work, to the movies, to just hang out, they're a threat. And you have to be aware that, as I told my sons, when you're hanging with your white boys, your friends, and a cop pulls you over, you're still the most dangerous person in that car.
Yeah.
With Michael, friends sitting there. So,
Michael, we've had, I mean, that was eloquent. Thank you. And that's, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening, that's why you need to subscribe to the Michael Steele podcast. You just got a sample right there available wherever you get your podcast. But, Michael, we have not had an African-American on the show who has not shared with us the importance of having what you just referenced, the talk. And I don't know how many of our listeners who are not African-American were aware of that before, but they all describe it in exactly the way you did. You now are, you're really in danger when you get stopped, and here's what you do. I mean, that just appears to be a rite of passage in the African-American community. Is that accurate?
It's very accurate, and it's unfortunate, and it needs to change. You know, and I think it needs to be very clear, and I think we understand this a little bit better in Baltimore, especially in the state of Maryland as a whole, than a lot of folks do. Because it was funny, I was doing an interview on MSNBC, and I was asked at the time, why aren't there riots and all of that happening in Baltimore? And I said, because we went through Freddie Gray. We know. And we know that that's a release, but we need more to do more than that. And we need to be more honest about what we have to do. And I appreciate the way Marylanders kind of represent it to the nation, a little bit more of that restraint and sort of not to say that that was an overreaction, because it wasn't, but there was a soberness from what I heard when I saw Marylanders on television talking about George Floyd and talking about the Freddie Gray killing and the outcome of all of that. There was a maturity. There was a sense of, okay, we're going to help the rest of the country. We're going to teach the rest of the country. And that's kind of what has been the genesis, if you will, of the talk. Is not only are you're sort of sharing, you know, survival skills for your sons, but you're also, by expressing it and sharing it with the broader white community, making them more aware that this is something I have to do with my kids that you don't have to do. You don't worry about your children when they encounter the police. In fact, you tell your children, if you get into trouble, to seek out the police. We tell our kids, well, you may want to think about that. You know, wow. You may not want to make that the first move, because it may not end well for you. And that's not a spot that we want to be in as a community, because
but the chilling part,
respect
Michael,
for the police.
The chilling part of that for me as a dad and a granddad, and I think it's what we do hope that all of our listeners try to process as we begin to have these important discussions, is when people talk about white privilege and what it is, that's not a conversation I ever had to have with my son. My conversation with my son was, don't be a knucklehead.
Right.
Not
ditto to me and my 35-year-old son, right.
Right,
right.
Don't be a knucklehead. But when I listen to you, Michael, there's such a, they're really in so many of your responses, there's sort of this spiritual sense of the way you're trying to analyze things. And I know once upon a time you were actually serious in your Catholicism about being a priesthood. I think you even studied several years to be a priest.
Yeah, I was Augustinian seminarian, yeah.
Yeah, for a couple of years. What part of that experience still informs who you are today?
All of it. All of it. I thank God every day for taking me down that road because it's foundational to everything I believe and everything I do. It is where my sense of patience and my sense of purpose comes from. I learned perseverance from my mom. You know, I learned patience from the gospel and the Holy Spirit, as they say. And it's important because it shed light on, for me at least, on how to look at people and to not just see their flaws, but to see past that and to see the person. Now, to be honest, there's some people, they can't help to show you their flaws. They can't help to show you the only thing they can show you is their flaws. And that makes it difficult sometimes. But you still have to try to find that better angel, if you will. And I do that. And I tried. And when I was lieutenant governor, that's the feeling, that's the spirit I brought to the work I did. Is, you know, how do I best serve the people of Maryland in the time that I'm served? And, you know, whether that's going to be for 4 years or 8 years or 2 weeks or whatever, I got to make the most of that time. And that's what's so disappointing to me about public service today. They take that time for granted. They assume so much about it. They presume their reelection. In some political systems, it's an absolute because they have the political structure, infrastructure to guarantee their election. But that's not good for the people, and it's not good for the state or the country. So I'd like to see more leaders lead with this sense of purpose beyond self and not be afraid to lose that primary, lose that general election, lose that reelection, standing on the kind of ground that they can be proud of and those that worked with them and served with them could be proud of. Because it's not, I mean, sometimes, I learned this through all, I tell you, being a black Republican particularly, you learn how to lose, right? But I've learned that losing isn't the worst thing that can happen to you. So I've seen a lot of winners wind up pretty messed up, pretty lost in the process. So that's what guides me, and being an Augustinian seminarian is one of the most blessed, proudest things that I've done and outside of serving as lieutenant governor.
Last thing for you, and we'll bid you adieu, is a little election coming up in November. It says R in front of your name. You know, the form comes out. Are we standing in line amidst the pandemic? We're not sure in Maryland. We haven't figured all that out yet, but assuming we'll vote by mail, where do you stand when I say, will you be voting your party? Because that's going to be a question for everyone.
Well, I've always voted. I've always voted in a way that I think empowers my community and works to the benefit of my community. I voted for Democrats. I voted for Republicans. I've had Democrats vote for me, obviously.
I'm one of them, by the way.
Thank you very much. And in fact, I had five wonderful Democrats stand with me when I ran for the U.S. Senate out of my home county of Prince George's County. They endorsed me against their party and paid a price for that. So I understand and appreciate that political sacrifice. And what I, you know, you raised the voting piece, working with not just our administration here in Maryland, but with administrations across the country, I've been working with a small team of folks trying to get the Congress to put more resources into the states so that we can safely vote from home, vote by mail, absentee ballot. And I would encourage everyone to do this, all your listeners. The moment the queue waits, you know, is open to get your November ballot, sign up for your absentee ballot. It won't come in August, obviously. It won't come in September, but you're on the list. It will come as soon as you get it, as soon as you turn that corner where they release the fall ballots, get that absentee ballot, vote it, and send it back in, because you don't want a situation where you wait till a week before the election, you know, your ballot may or may not come in time, and then you've got to return it, and it may or may not get there in time, and all of that. Just the moment the line is open to receive your ballot and the state is ready to begin to take those ballots back, request your absentee ballot, request your ballot to vote by mail, because that's your civic responsibility to be proactive in this pandemic era, to make sure you can exercise your franchise. So I encourage everyone to vote. Vote your conscience. Vote for the kind of leadership you want, and vote for the kind of country and the kind of state that you want. So we don't have any state offices on the ballot this fall. We have congressional offices, for sure, but I encourage everyone to exercise that franchise in a responsible way.
Mike, we appreciate you taking time and joining us. And it was always good seeing you around when you're up here in the free state. And I know we haven't been out and about, but we owe you a crab cake or some shrimp and grits, some chicken and waffles, something good. we'll get Evan to put the meatloaf back on the platter over there.
There we go.
State Fair. Really appreciate it. Good. Tell everybody about your podcast. And because we podcast, I've been doing radio for 30 years. It's an interesting time when everybody has their voice at this point. And I know you put a lot into your podcast.
I do. And just real quick, you can catch it on the Michael Steele Podcast, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcast on. I particularly want to just call your attention. I did a reflection on the 4th of July and the American Dream. If you start with that podcast, you download that one, you'll get a sense of what my podcasts are like. We have a nice array of guests from across the political spectrum, and we have a lot of fun. It's like a barbershop conversation for those who are familiar with barbershops and hair salons. So we kind of keep it real and honest and closest to the street, and it's a lot of fun. So check it out.
Well, we appreciate it.
Hey, Michael, what time? Things that our inquiring listeners want to know. What in the world time do you have to get up to make a 6 o'clock segment on Morning Joe?
Oh, my God.
Appear bright-eyed.
Well, now it's 5 o'clock because all I have to do is walk downstairs to my office. Sitting in front of the camera. When I was going into the studio, it was 4 a.m. So,
holy mackerel.
Well, we appreciate it. You're a great follow out on Twitter. I follow you. Everybody can find the work of Michael Steele and the Michael Steele podcast. Don, are we done with the Lieutenant Governor?
I think so. It's been great. We hope you'll become a regular. It's really been great.
Gentlemen, it's been a lot of fun. I can't wait till we can break bread over some crab cakes and a beer. And I look forward to coming back on. And I promise you, Nestor, I promise you, it will not be a year and a half, bro.
Well, I like hearing that, Michael. That's good because we want to be fair and balanced here, you know. And
I appreciate that.
If you stick around long enough, we'll share our Taharka ice cream with you. That'll let you know.
Now we're talking.
Then we'll be left center is where we'll be here. Yeah, appreciate you. Michael Steele joining us here, the man, the myth, the legend. And Don knows how long I've wanted Michael Steele on. We chased him down and we've held him up almost an hour. We've been going a little longer. We appreciate our friends at State Fair. We wish we could be over in the 212-28 doing these broadcasts. Maybe we'll be back to doing that in fall. We certainly hope so. Fadley's down in Lexington Market, still shipping those crab cakes out. You can find a great conversation that I had with Damie Hahn and Jack Brooks from the Waterman over on the Eastern Shore in the Cambridge area about where those crabs come from and how those crab cakes, where that meat comes from, and how there's a real shortage of labor over in the Eastern Shore right now. Very, very important if you love those Fadley's crab cakes as much as we do. Also, Moeller & Gary Realty. I want to give Jeff Moeller a shout-out. You can find him at MoellerandGary.com. The listings, you can search, read all up about the community there, 410-489-2621 and MoellerandGary.com. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, and with thanks to former Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. We do sports some of the time, but there ain't no sports right now. We're calm, we're local, and we're always Baltimore positive.